You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Abousfian Abdelrazik is a Canadian citizen from Montreal who has been living in the Canadian Embassy in Khartoum for over a year. In 2003, he went back to the Sudan to visit his sick mother. While he was there, he was thrown into jail and tortured on suspicion of ties to Al-Qaeda. In March, the Globe and Mail newspaper made public documents indicating that the Canadian Security Intelligence Service had asked the Sudanese authorities to detain Mr. Abdelrazik. Although the RCMP and CSIS now say that they have nothing on him, the Canadian government has been refusing to provide him the travel documents he needs to return to Canada. On June 4th, Federal Court Judge Justice Zinn ordered the Canadian government to bring Mr. Abdelrazik back to Canada. Yesterday, he was unable to use an airline ticket bought for him through the contributions of 150 Canadians because he still has no passport. Khalid Elgazar is one of Mr. Abdelrazik's lawyers, and he joins me today from Ontario. Hello, Khalid.
Morning, Jane.
Let's talk first of all about the judgment. What did Justice Zinn say about the Canadian government's actions in this case?
The judgment was a resounding indictment of the federal government's action and inaction and their interpretation of international law, especially in the case of Mr. Abdelrazik. Some of the findings of the judge were that, for example, CSIS was complicit in the detention of Mr. Abdelrazik by Sudanese authorities in 2003. Also that in or around 2004, mid-2004, it seems that federal officials had decided that they were not going to help Mr. Abdelrazik return to Canada, and that, in fact, they were going to try to find ways to keep him out of Canada. And Justice Zinn had made that finding of fact in his June 4th judgment. Justice Zinn also found that the argument of the federal government that Mr. Abdelrazik is unable to return to Canada as a result of his listing on a UN list of persons suspected to be associated with Al Qaeda or Taliban is not an impediment to his returning to Canada. So that their argument actually leads to a nonsensical result, and those are the words of the judge. So. There were some very, very strong indictments of the federal government's position on this file.
I read that one of the things that Justice Zinn said was that Mr. Abdelrazik could no more prove that he wasn't a member of Al-Qaeda than he could prove that fairies didn't exist.
Yes, that's right. I think the exact wording of that line was that one cannot prove that fairies and goblins do not exist any more than Mr. Abdelrazik or any other person can prove that they are or are not an Al-Qaeda associate. And one of the major problems with the 1267 regime of the United Nations is that, well, first of all, you can be listed based on suspicion alone, no real proof. The people who are listed, persons who are listed, are not afforded a hearing during which they can defend themselves or sort of allay those suspicions. And of course, it seems to reverse the burden of proof, whereas in our justice system, a person is innocent until proven guilty. However, under this regime, the person has to prove themselves innocent. So in other words, they're presumed to be guilty. And of course, there are very serious consequences to being listed on the 1267 list, and those are the consequences that Mr. Abdelrazik has wrongly suffered for the past few years, and the federal court has found that that was an error. Another problem with the 1267 regime is that it's not impartial. Mr. Justice Zinn has found that in this case, for example, the accuser can also be the judge. In other words, the states or states that request the listing of an individual are also the people who decide whether or not they remain on the list. And so that's clearly impartial and a breach of natural justice.
Now, this list, which was set up, I believe, in 1999 against the Taliban and then was used subsequently to 9/11 for people who were believed to be terrorists, what does it actually do when you are on that list? What does it actually mean?
There are essentially three effects that a person is subject to once they're listed. First, it's a travel ban. So member states are required to refuse travel or to impede the movement of members or persons on that list. The second is an asset freeze, and the third is an arms embargo. No one is really concerned about the arms embargo in the case of Mr. Abdul Razak. The real issues were primarily the travel ban and the asset freeze. However, it should be pointed out that in the 1267 regime itself, there are a number of exceptions and exemptions that are contained, and one of the exceptions is for return to one's country of nationality. Another exception is to travel for the purposes of the fulfillment of a judicial process, and finally is an exemption on a case-by-case basis. In other words, if a state, and only a state, can make a request for this exemption, decides that they want an exemption for a listed person from the travel ban or the asset freeze, then they can request that. And the Canadian government has actually done that in the case of Mr. Abdul Razak in order to provide him with a monthly stipend so that he may eat, for example, while he's in de facto exile in the Canadian embassy.
So in a sense, they've applied for an exception in order to make sure that he doesn't starve on the grounds of the Canadian embassy, but they're not prepared to apply for an exemption to get him back to Canada.
That seems to be the case, but even further than that, Justice Zinn found that they don't need to seek an exemption in this case, that the regime itself is not an impediment to Mr. Abdul Razak returning to Canada. Therefore, the government's argument that his charter rights aren't in play because he hasn't presented himself at a Canadian border since he's unable to travel is wrong. Their interpretation is nonsensical. Those were the words used by the judge. And in fact, on the eve of the hearing in late May of this year, an official, I think the top official at the UN 1267 committee, actually confirmed to a number of media outlets here in Canada that the Canadian government's position was in fact wrong, and that it was totally up to the Canadian government whether or not to bring Mr. Abdul Razak back. And that's that finding was confirmed by Justice Sin's finding of June 4th.
Now, Mr. Abdul Razak has been asked to appear before the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs in Ottawa on Monday, this coming Monday. Now, I don't get this. This is a government body, and yet the government is not providing a way for him to get back.
That's right. It seems what has happened is the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs has formally requested Mr. Abdul Razak's attendance and has scheduled him to be present before the committee this coming Monday, the 15th. As a result, the Standing Committee itself had requested in writing, I believe, that the Minister of Foreign Affairs issue a travel document to allow Mr. Abdul Razak to return. A ticket had already been purchased and paid for him to return to leave Khartoum yesterday. Once again, the minister ignored that request, and Mr. Abdul Razak remains in Khartoum.
What specifically did Judge Zinn order the Canadian government to do?
Well, that's a very interesting. That's the most interesting part of the judgment is that Justice Zinn has ordered that within 15 days of the judgment itself. Well, first of all, and most importantly, Justice Zinn had declared that Mr. Abdul Razak's right under Section 6 of the Charter had been breached by the government, and in light of that breach, had ordered a very specific remedy, and the remedy was that the government is directed, to issue an emergency passport to Mr. Abdul Razak so that he can return, and that arrangements for his travel back to Canada had to be made within 15 days of the judgment. Now, by my calculation, that's by June 19th, so this coming week, by the end of this coming week. Arrangements will have to have been made for Mr. Abdul Razak, And those arrangements have to be made in consultation with Mr. Abdulrazak through his legal counsel. After those arrangements are made, the court has ordered that Mr. Abdulrazak actually be repatriated, in other words, that he actually arrive in Canada no later than 30 days from the date of the judgment, which brings us to early July. And then even further, in order to assure itself that Mr. Abdulrazak has actually been repatriated, the court has ordered that Mr. Abdulrazak appear before the court in Montreal on July 7th, 2009.
Now, you are one of Mr. Abdulrazak's legal counsel, and the government is supposed to consult with you. Have you heard anything about the travel documents that are supposed to be ready by next Friday?
No, we've made several inquiries this past week, we've been receiving, I think, the same line as all Canadian citizens have been receiving from their government. That's the government is studying the judgment, they're reviewing the judgment. We've heard nothing on any positive steps that they're taking to either issue a travel document or make any arrangements for Mr. Abdulrazak to return.
And I understand that they've been asked questions about this in question period. How have they responded?
Again, it's been the same line. It's been we're studying the judgment. It's a long judgment. I can tell you that we poured over that judgment and had it read from end to end in less than one afternoon, but the government seems content to continue with the same line that they're reviewing the judgment and they're not going to speak about it until they're done. And so all questions leveled at the Minister of Foreign Affairs in question period have been, to the best of my knowledge, answered by the Attorney General, the Minister of Justice, Mr. Nicholson, who continues to essentially just say that the government is studying the judgment. But of course, given the very strict timelines within the judgment itself, the government has very little time left to continue studying the judgment and has to put it into effect very shortly.
If the government appeals the ruling, which I guess is the concern, how long could that process then take?
It's hard to say. I mean, it could take anywhere from, the appeal itself could take anywhere from, I would say, 4 or 5 months to be, I mean, it could be even longer than that. It's hard to say because we're not sure on what grounds they would be appealing and what procedural steps might or might not be required in order to actually get to a hearing before the Federal Court of Appeal. However, I think it's worth pointing out that the appeal itself, or the fact that the government might appeal the decision, doesn't absolve the government from its obligation to immediately implement the order of the federal court. And the only way for them to avoid implementation of that order is either to breach it or to seek a stay of the order itself from the Federal Court of Appeal. And we have no indication one way or the other what the government intends to do.
What do you think is behind the government's refusal to allow Mr. Abdulrazak back?
That's a question that's been on my mind personally since my involvement on this file, but it's hard to say. I suspect it's a political issue, and that's a shame because someone's human rights are at play, and I personally don't think that it has anything to do with national security, contrary to what the Minister of Foreign Affairs would have Canadian citizens believe. Since, of course, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service itself and the RCMP have both cleared Mr. Abdulrazak, not to mention the Sudanese. They've also cleared him. So for the Minister of Foreign Affairs to then turn around and say that this is an issue of national security is again nonsensical. It's rather disingenuous, I would say. And you know, it's clear that Mr. Abdulrazak, who the government claims is a threat to national security of either Canada or some other country, is living in the Canadian Embassy, which is obviously a building that has very high security requirements. So it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up.
Now, when you say it's a political issue, it's obviously not a partisan political issue because the Liberal government and the Conservative government have pursued the same policy. So I guess the only option it would be to avoid political embarrassment then.
I mean, that's possible. I don't know that I necessarily want to speculate on that. What I can say is that of late, I believe members of the Liberal Party have has spoken out against the government's continued refusal to issue Mr. Abdulrazak a passport. I think that the decision rests squarely within the ambit of the current government, and Justice Sin has again, very severely indicted their actions and their decision making, and I think it's an affront to Mr. Abdulrazak, but also to any Canadian citizen, to find out that your own government might actually take steps to prevent you from returning to your country of citizenship. Keeping in mind that, of course, the government is in a position of trust vis-a-vis its citizens. Citizens can be in very vulnerable situations where they need their government to come through for them, and this government has actively thwarted all efforts by Mr. Abdulrazak to come back to Canada in recent years.
How is Mr. Abdulrazak's health?
His physical health certainly is not good. His eyesight has suffered tremendously of late. It seems that he's now suffering from diabetes, which he didn't suffer from before. We believe that he may have suffered a stroke a few months ago in the embassy itself, and because, of course, he's unable to leave the embassy for fear of his security and his life, it's very hard to get him proper medical assistance. We'd requested at the time of the suspected stroke that the government immediately take steps to bring him home for his own safety. That request was refused. As far as his mental health goes, I mean, I'm not qualified to comment on it, but I think if anyone were to put themselves through the ordeal that Mr. Abdulrazak has been in, I think it's safe to say that his state is fragile at best, and it's very difficult. I mean, you can't rely on your own government, and he's essentially alone, right? I mean, he's away from his family, he's away from his support structure, and his government has abandoned him. So that's a very difficult position to be in. Not to mention the torture that he's undergone while in detention. I mean, it's just a horrible ordeal. But I'm sure more will come to light in the coming weeks and months about Mr. Abdulrazak's health.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Khaled.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Khaled Elgazar. He's one of the lawyers for Abu Sufyan Abdulrazak.